From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Hala Ayala, who is a member of the Virginia House of Representatives. She is a Democrat, and joining us now in studio is Kenyon McDuffie. He's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 5. He is a Democrat. Councilmember McDuffie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me back on, Kojo.
First, Tom Sherwood, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, who was skeptical back in 2015 about accepting refugees, now says in a letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that Maryland is willing to accept refugees once they have been properly vetted. What's the significance of that?
Well, this is part of the President Trump signed an executive order requiring the states to acknowledge in writing whether they would accept refugees or not. More than 30 states have. Governor Northam did it in Virginia last November. And it basically just says we will accept refugees. There had been some concerns that refugees from Syria and other places might create a terrorism threat in this country. But I think people realize now that, and as Governor Hogan said, if he has vetted refugees that have gone through the process to be in the country, then the state will accept them. The overall picture is that President Trump has tried to severely limit the number of refugees coming into the country, and his requirement that they specifically state they will accept them. Give some states an opportunity to say, no, they won't, but most have.
Even though Governor Hogan pointed out that Maryland is not a sanctuary state.
Well, that was part of the political icing on, icing on the cake.
D.C. hate crimes prosecutions rise as support grows for changing the city's law. That's the headline in the Washington Post, a story by Michael E. Miller and Stephen Rich. The headline might be a little bit exaggerated because Councilmember Charles Allen of Ward 6 says it's underwhelming to try to celebrate an increase of a handful of cases being prosecuted as hate crimes when we are seeing this dramatic increase. He means this dramatic increase of alleged hate crimes in the District of Columbia and a very small increase in prosecutions.
Well, hate crimes are a horrible issue across the country just with the attacks on the Jewish people in New York. But here in the district, there's been more than 100 cases that have been sent to prosecutors, and only a true handful, five, six, or seven of them, have actually been prosecuted for a variety of reasons. And given the temper and tone of politics in the country, the district government and citizens want the prosecutor to be tougher. And that's where we stand.
Well, we're talking with a former prosecutor here, Kenyon McDuffie.
And a former chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
And the U.S. attorney has said that the district maybe needs to change its laws regarding hate crime, especially when it comes to jury instructions, because that may be a part of the problem. What do you see as the problem?
I think it's a combination of what's being said. I think, obviously, you know, trying to prove a hate crime is not as easy as some people might hope. It is. But on the other hand, you want to make sure that you have prosecutors who are being zealous and making sure that they are enforcing the law and getting justice for victims. And so I think that's important. And to the extent that the U.S. attorney thinks that the law needs to be changed, I know that my colleague Charles Allen is always open to having conversations to make sure. And that goes for, I think, the majority of the members on the council, in fact, myself included, where we can strengthen laws if there are gaps to try to make sure that we tighten up enforcement, particularly around something as horrible as hate crimes.
The current U.S. attorney, Jesse Liu, is leaving to go to, Maine Justice. Do you have any hope that the next U.S. attorney will be someone who, A, lives in the District of Columbia, and B, will be more collegial with the city government?
I'm generally an optimist, and so I'm always hopeful. I guess my hope is that this administration would be open to recommendations that come from Congressman Eleanor Holmes Norton and others who have traditionally been supportive of trying to make sure that the president has qualified candidates.
You used to work connection. In that office, right?
I used to work at the Department of Justice, but I worked at Maine Justice in the Civil Rights Division. I was a prosecutor in Prince George's County. And so I do have some experience there. I was an intern in the U.S. Attorney's Office several years ago during law school. But it's always important where we do not have the ability to elect our own local prosecutor, that we have a say in the matter, and with this administration, they have not demonstrated a willingness to be open to the process as it has been the case for Democratic administrations in the past.
That's very politely said. Do you do any legal work now?
I do not do any legal work right now. I've not practiced law since I was elected to the Council of the District of Columbia.
You introduced a bill in September called the Protecting Local Area Commercial Enterprises, or PLACE, Amendment Act, which would provide assistance for small local businesses with an established track record of operating in D.C. with, quoting here, expenses beyond their control, things like sharp increases in rent or property taxes. Tell us a little bit more about the PLACE Act. What kind of businesses are you trying to help? And how will it work when implemented?
Sure. I'm trying to help businesses, like Sankofa Video Books and Cafe. We had a hearing
which did get help.
It got a tax abatement. And I, we did a hearing on that tax abatement legislation earlier this year. And what became apparent to some people for the first time, but not to me, because I've been having these conversations with small businesses for the last several years since I took over as chairmanship of the Committee on Business and Economic Development, what became apparent to some people around the Sankofa issue was that long-term legacy businesses like Sankofa are finding it increasingly difficult to maintain their businesses in the District of Columbia, whether you own your business or not, right? So if you own your business like Sankofa, then your property taxes are steadily going up in and around you, and it's impacting your ability to stay in business. If you don't own your business, and unfortunately, have a triple net lease where you're paying, all the taxes that are being, directed your way, then it's, difficult whether you're a legacy business or not to do business in the District of Columbia. So this bill was designed to try to address the issues associated with those long-term businesses like Sankofa that have been around for a while, that are institutions in some cases, and communities across the District of Columbia who are finding it more difficult to stay in business. One of the people who testified at our hearing, Tom, was the owner of Florida Avenue Grill, who testified that he experienced nearly a 400% increase in his property taxes over the time that he's owned the business.
The Florida Avenue Grill, though, is that still owned by the original? It's not
the Wilson. No, the Wilsons anymore. Right, this is a younger guy who. Right. It is a kind of legacy business, but he's not actually a member of that family.
Who would decide? Sometimes people worry that the law sounds good, but then it gets into the meat grinder of government bureaucracy. Who will there be precise definitions of who is a legacy business? Will it be a 10-15 year limit that you have to be in business? And a lot of new businesses, which are culturally important in parts of the city, are the very ones who go out of business in their first year because they're undercapitalized.
Right.
But this is on one end of the spectrum that you're dealing with.
And it's important to make that point, Tom, that this bill is designed to address issues with long-term legacy businesses. We're working on trying to define what that year would look like. There's been
Kojo would be a legacy business.
Kojo is a legacy.
I'm
an institution. He's an institution.
I'm a nonprofit
in the district. We support him wholeheartedly. But those long-term businesses. So we're trying to work through what that year is going to be. Probably somewhere in the range of 20 years. On the other hand, it's important to point out that as you mentioned, there are new businesses that struggle in the District of Columbia as well. This bill wasn't designed to address their issues, but there are bills pending before my committee that we've had hearings on that would provide.
Charles Allen has introduced a tax credit bill.
Brianna Doe and others have introduced measures to try to address issues that are faced by businesses that have not been in business very long, but nonetheless experienced the challenges in this climate where the value of real estate continues to go up.
The bottom line is that this district is becoming an exceedingly expensive place to do business, to live, to rent an apartment, to do anything.
And so, that's the bottom line. If you truly want to be a world-class city, I think we need to make sure that we have a government that's working to make it more economically inclusive for people, families, and businesses to thrive, and I think we've got some work ahead of us.
I heard this morning when I woke up on WAMU, the story out of Los Angeles where people are living in pods, where people have a warehouse, and they have these pods of people, literally are pod people. They have a very small space where they can sleep and store some of their goods, cost them $50 a night or something like that, $1,000 a month. But we have a lot of people in our city, not just homeless people, but people are trying to stay in their homes and keep their businesses alive.
Absolutely. There are people who are living in, you know, English basements, people who are living in accessory dwellings, and I think our Independent Zoning Commission, you know, over the last few years has you know, made some adjustments to our laws, regulations around zoning to try to recognize how expensive it's become to live in the District of Columbia. And I think the process that we're going through now with our comprehensive plan is extremely important. And I will, you know, recognize that Mayor Muriel Bowser has a goal of creating 36,000 new housing units across the District of Columbia and 12,000 affordable. And it's something that we need to do like yesterday.
Do you agree that we can get rid of the single family zoning, that in any residential property could have one, two ancillary dwellings?
I don't know if that's the solution that we need to implement the entire city.
Can you see that happening in Cleveland Park?
I think there are areas. I think there are areas of the district that we should target and focus to make sure that they're more inclusive. To recognize that the District of Columbia is still a very racially segregated housing market. The further east you go, the less expensive and the more people of color you're going to find, and the less expensive the housing is. The further west you go, like this area where we are here along Connecticut Avenue, when you go up to Wisconsin, MacArthur Boulevard, the wider it gets and the more expensive the real estate.
Two questions related to that. Does any of the language in your bill about businesses deal with the issue of race, businesses owned by people of color or by women?
That particular legislation does not. However, I am working really hard as chair of the Committee on Business and Economic Development to address opportunities for people who are in business who have historically been discriminated against, and that's minorities and women. And so I actually funded a disparity study for the Department of Small and Local Business Development to conduct in order to attempt to move our what's now a certified business enterprise program. You guys who are a little older, like Tom and Kojo, will recognize.
Remember
when we had a minority business enterprise program, which the Court of Appeal, actually the Federal Circuit Court for District of Columbia, said was unconstitutional. They didn't say we couldn't do it. They just said that we didn't do it right. And so one of the things we need to do in order to do it right is to have a study that demonstrates that there is a current disparity. And I want to get that study done so we can make sure that the resources that we're using to create, to help, and opportunities for our small businesses actually target people who have historically been discriminated against. That's minorities and women.
We got a tweet from Coy with, will Councilmember McDuffie follow up on an email exchange to arrange a meeting to discuss reforming BIDs, business improvement districts?
Yes.
What needs to be reformed?
I'm not sure what exactly Coy is referring to. I know he's corresponded with my staff and I about his bid proposal, and I'm happy to meet with him. I think that's something that we're working on.
The big picture over all of this is last year you introduced a racial equity bill, which in short term basically says whatever action the government takes, it needs to consider the racial implications of discrimination or exclusion and future effect. Now, I think that bill is still pending in the council. Is that correct?
It is. It's pending
before. And you hope that there'll be a hearing.
Oh, we had a big hearing. A number of witnesses came out.
Where's it stand?
We're working with my colleague, Brandon Todd, who chairs the committee that has oversight. He has indicated his support for the bill. It's just a matter of trying to make sure that we get it out of committee. We still have any bill that's been introduced last year. It still has an opportunity to be marked up out of committee and passed by the full council by the end of the calendar year 2020. So we've got some time to work on it, but it's received tremendous support, and I think it's something that we sorely need to do in the District of Columbia to make sure that we're measuring our progress and performance as a government through the lens of racial equity.
And we got a tweet from a politician aspiring to be on the council. Anthony Lorenzo Green is an ANC commissioner, and he's seeking the Ward 7 seat. Does Councilmember McDuffie support funding grocery stores east of the river? And what's his take on the failure to secure funding for the construction of those stores?
I'm not sure what he means. I know Commissioner Green well. He's been an activist over in Ward 7, has done a number of things around some of the challenges in Deanwood and other areas in the ward, and so I appreciate his service to the district. When he says failure to fund, I'm not sure what proposal he's talking about. I can say specifically that I've worked with Councilmember Vincent Gray, as well as Councilmember Trayon White, and my colleague Mary Che, to put money in the budget to support grocery stores east of the Anacostia River. Phil Mendelson has been supportive of that. We've put money in the budget to try to support those efforts in the past, and I will continue to support those efforts. We need to make sure that every resident in the District of Columbia, regardless of where you live, regardless of your zip code, has access to healthy food options.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Hala Ayala, a member of the Virginia House of Delegates, a Democrat. I'm Kojo Nandi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. Our guest is Kenyon McDuffie. He's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 5. He's a Democrat. Our resident analyst is Tom Sherwood. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. The last time we had you on this show in March, the D.C. Council had just voted unanimously to reprimand Ward 2 Council member Jack Evans. Now the situation is different. Last month, the council unanimously voted to recommend his removal from office. And you can excuse our listeners and residents if they're a little confused that there's a difference between recommending his removal from office and actually voting to remove him from office, because the full council will be voting, will be doing that vote sometime later this month. Can you tell us quickly about the process and if you will in fact vote to remove him?
Sure. We have a legislative meeting coming up on Tuesday, and after that meeting there'll be a meeting.
Special
an
meeting.
Opportunity for the council member to address his colleagues on the council. So sort of a hearing of sorts that Chairman Mendelson will conduct. And then following that, there'll be a vote on January 21st where we take up the actual recommendation to remove and decide whether or not to remove via.
Well, all 12, the 13 members on the council, Jack Evans is one of 13, all 12 others, including you, voted, in, as Kojo said, in December to recommend that he be expelled. He would be the first council member in the history of the legislature since the 70s to be expelled. You voted that you would expel him. Are you aware of your, and you or any other council member changed their mind? I don't think so.
No, I'm not aware of any other council member who's changed their mind. I definitely have not changed my mind. I've obviously reviewed all the records and evidence and facts that have been compiled through the various investigations, whether it's the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability.
Have you spoken to Jack Evans yourself personally to
absolutely
recommend to him? But because you guys have a pretty friendly relationship, you
sure,
meaning that all the council members basically have a collegial atmosphere there. All of them, to my knowledge, in speaking to Evans, have said this would be better for you, your family, the council, the city, if you stepped away rather than being expelled.
Absolutely.
Have you spoken to him?
I have spoken to Jack more than a couple of times, and you know, most recently before I voted to recommend his removal, I spoke to him and I asked him to resign, point blank. You know, in light of everything that's come out about his conduct, I think it is appropriate for him to take that step. I think it would be, I don't want to put myself in his position and begin to imagine what he's going through, but I've got to think about what's best for the residents of the District of Columbia. He's got to think about what's best for the residents of Ward 2 and the district and his family, and I hope that he makes the right decision.
A lot of this has to do with the council members' other jobs, so to speak. In November, you introduced legislation that would prohibit D.C. council members from holding outside employment. You also want to raise council members' salaries. Ward 1 council member Brianne Nadeau introduced a similar bill in April that would bar outside employment with the exception of teaching jobs. Her bill was co-introduced by the majority of the council. Why did your bill not include that exception?
I think the council needs to draw a very clear and bold line about where it stands on outside employment.
Let's be clear.
Sure.
The Nadeau bill protects Ward 3 Councilmember Mary Che, who is a law professor at George Washington University.
Sure, sure. I don't know.
And you don't.
Well, I mean, it's not about a single council member. And so I didn't have Councilmember Che or any other member of the council individually in mind when I crafted this measure. This was a measure recognizing where we are in the District of Columbia politically and the need to restore the public's trust. And I think to put something in place that allows the institution of the council to function better than it's currently functioning.
Well, Councilmember Nadeau said she hoped you had, would consult with Councilmember Che about your bill. Councilmember Che said you didn't, and she said, I think it's interesting that this bill comes from somebody with whom I've clashed occasionally on the council. I wonder what the real motivation is here, especially since there's already a bill to ban outside employment that makes an exception for teaching. How would you respond?
I think the motivation is clear, that we need to do what's in the best interest of the 700,000+ residents of the District of Columbia and not think about one council member in particular when we craft legislation.
Well, I know there are other legislative bodies who do also have that exception because teaching is seen by a lot of people as a very noble profession.
Is it more noble than being a firefighter or a police officer or some other public service?
Well, and also, and I have a great deal of respect for Mary Che about this, but the education is one of the most politically charged, whether you're in Maryland where they're trying to do the Kerwin report on billions of dollars, or in Virginia where the billions of dollars are at stake, or in the district where teachers and where schools are and how we have schools. It's one of the most political worlds in our entire community. And so teachers are very political. How about George Washington University and Georgetown and Howard and American? Those are very political organizations that want stuff from the council.
Some of the largest employers.
Right, the largest employers.
As well, and real estate owners as well.
I'm not that in favor. I could argue against excluding outside income because I think disclosure is the issue. You have to have a lot more disclosure. And then people can do what they want. We have citizen legislators. But if you're going to ban outside employment, how can you carve that out? What about ministers?
Yeah, I mean, ministers.
They're
and
more
other
political than educators. We won't
and then
get
there's also
that.
The issue that a whole host of teachers locally in our DC public school system wouldn't be able to run for public office for other reasons like the Hatch Act. And so right. I think you have a limited pool of folks who you actually protect by carving out for teachers. And I think it's best to create a bold and clear line.
A whole lot of people would like to speak with you. Let's start with Brian on Capitol Hill. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I want to thank Councilman McDuffie and our Councilman Charles Allen for all the work they're doing with our small businesses. Happen to be ANC Commissioner in Capitol Hill 6B03 that represents half of Barracks Row, and I know our businesses definitely need the help for the tax abatement and other challenges to help them thrive and continue to move forward. Just recently, we just lost one of our businesses. They've decided to, Medium Rare decided to close its doors on Barracks Row to focus on some other areas, which I understand, which is a business decision, but I do think the work that you guys are doing will definitely help with our remaining business and future businesses that are coming in.
Wait, can we just say that 8th Street is a very popular place with lots and lots of restaurants, kind of like 14th Street here in the district, but a lot of them are having trouble.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're not necessarily legacy businesses.
They aren't necessarily legacy businesses, and they are having trouble. And you think about where 8th Street and Barracks Row has come over the last 20 or 30 years. It's come a very long way, and it's some of the pricier real estate along that corridor on Capitol Hill, as is the case in Shaw.
All I know is that 8th Street was where I bought my last bicycle, and when I went to go there to look for a new one, the bike store was gone.
I bought my bike there.
Here's Kenneth in Washington, D.C. Kenneth, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, good day, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity. I also want to – my wife owns a business in that area as well, too, which is Agile on Pennsylvania Avenue. And like the other businesses, she's struggling as well, which to me is very unusual – particularly because it's female-owned and minority-owned also. And one of the things that we do, we work with the Department of Employment Services, but it takes forever and ever for them to process students to come through. I've had to contact the deputy mayor on multiple occasions. They, you know, we try and get a class for students every month to help them.
What are you hoping the council member can do?
To try and help streamline the system that they already have in place. Some of the things that they said, one time computers were down, they couldn't do anything. I'm like, have you ever heard of paper and pen?
The Department of Employment Services, if people always complain about DCRA, but if you
that's
look
coming
at,
up next.
if you look at it, Department of Employment Services is horrific.
Well, I think kind of maybe talking about the Maryberry's the youth employment summer youth employment program, and he's trying to bring students to. I heard him say, and so we obviously, you know, working with Director Unique Morris Hughes, it's important to make sure that we streamline any process where you create opportunities for youth and teenagers all the way up to, I think, 23 now to get opportunities for employment. I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges that we face in the District of Columbia is access to meaningful opportunity for employment. We have some of the highest rates of employment in Wards 5, 7, and 8. And any process to streamline to allow businesses like Kenneth's Wife's to be able to hire our young adults, then we need to make sure that we're reducing the red tape.
Here is Bill in Adams Morgan. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, good afternoon. I might have one of those legacy businesses. We've been in business for about 28 years. But I wanted to ask the council member about his oversight of the Alcohol Beverage Regulation Administration. And it seems that there has never been a member of the hospitality industry that sits on the board. And I can't imagine any other board or commission that would oversee an industry this large without any input at all from a member of the
To which you say what, Council Member McDuffie?
I appreciate the call.
The chairperson. No, I've spoken with the council members also before. The chairperson of the board, by his own bio, is a lawyer who represents special interest children in education. He was just reappointed for another 4 years. That's 8 years as a chairperson. There's now openings on the board, and it just seems that it would be opportune time to put a member of the hospitality industry or two on that board to oversee their industry.
I'm not opposed to having a member who has some experience in the hospitality industry be a member of the ABRA board. On the other hand, the hospitality industry isn't the only industry where issues around alcoholic beverage regulation come into play. And so I think that, and the other thing is the council doesn't appoint nominees. We give us advice and consent. And so the mayor makes those nominations. I generally try to work with any mayor who's in that position around nominations.
You could change the law, though, and require someone from the industry like we do with Metro and other
Sure. I mean, we could do something like that, but you have to recognize how important it is to have people with ordinary experience in the community also be able to weigh in on issues that involve alcoholic beverage regulation.
Down to 1 minute left, and Elise has turned her radio down. So, Elise, go.
Yes. Council Member McDuffie and Alan, we thank you for all the great work you do. DCRA is absolutely an abominable place to go on every other day. They make up new rules consistently. And
what would you like to see done?
We need to streamline the ability to get a business up and running. When you're spending $3,000 and $4,000 and $5,000 a month for rent.
I'm pretty sure the council member is familiar with this problem.
No, we've had a lot of complaints about DCRA. In fact, the council's focused extensively on trying to improve and reform Department of Consumer Regulatory Affairs. Chairman Mendelson, in particular, has oversight of that agency.
A bill to break it up.
He has a bill to break it up. I'm not sure if that's the right course. On the other hand, I hear that complaint all the time that Elisa just mentioned. It's too burdensome to start a business, and even after you've, gotten past all the hurdles to start a business, the burden placed on you to all the fines and fees and taxes and trying to keep up while you run your business really is extremely burdensome to small business in the District of Columbia. And in some cases, we have to recognize that people can take their businesses elsewhere. I think we take for granted that people have to run and maintain business in the District of Columbia. If we've got jurisdictions on either side of the river who are making it a friendly business environment, then we have to recognize that people don't have to stay here.
Kenyon McDuffie is a member of the D.C. Council. He represents Ward 5. He's a Democrat. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Hala Ayala. She's a member of the Virginia House of Delegates. She's a Democrat. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. Our guest is Hala Ayala. She's a member of the Virginia House of Delegates representing District 51 in Prince William County. She is a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Thank you, Tommy.
If you have questions for the House member, you should call now, 800-433-8850. Don't wait until it's too late. Just a couple of quick things about Virginia, Tom Sherwood, and feel free to join in, Hala Ayala. There's a poll that says that Joe Biden is the only Democrat who would defeat Donald Trump in Virginia among the leading four Democrats at this point. Biden is campaigning fairly heavily in Virginia. Too soon?
Well, I don't want to correct you, but actually Biden and all the other Democrats mentioned are within the margin of error.
True.
And Biden is ahead of Trump, and Trump is barely ahead of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg. I would never say his name right. Mayor Pete. But, you know, it's early. You can just ask Republicans how popular President Trump is in Virginia, but given the last two election cycles. So I think this is really too early to take much stock in it.
Are you of the same view, Hala Ayala?
I haven't seen the poll. For me, I'm just getting through an election. But I would say Virginians spoke loud and clear about how they felt about where Virginia was and where it is now. And we're just excited about what the future holds.
Do you agree that President Trump was a big factor in elections across the board?
I think that there is some, to really get into the logistics or the rationale of it, he did have a tone. You know, this nation, we elected someone who in my community and how I felt, did not represent our American values.
And Governor Ralph Northam says he's going to pushing for legislation to replace Virginia's statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee that's housed in the U.S. Capitol building. The other one, of course, is George Washington. I
don't think there's any controversy right now about George Washington.
No, not at this point. But there has always been controversy over General Robert E. Lee. But I think, Hala Ayala, he's going to need your help on this because this is legislation in the General Assembly.
And this is going to be an interesting conversation. It is yet to unfold. But I do believe, Kojo and Tommy, that this is something that we will be seeing as a particular discussion. There, like other pieces of legislation and issues that are near and dear to our heart, we have to, again, move Virginia forward. And what does that look like?
Well, Robert E. Lee is the biggest statue on Monument Avenue, I believe.
You talking about physically big?
I mean, physically, it's huge. I mean, you go stand by it. It's like 30, 40 feet up in the air. It's huge. But the one in the Capitol, who would you recommend be replaced to replace Robert E. Lee?
How about Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman? How about, Ida
don't
B.
They have
Wells?
To have a hardcore, they have to be from the state of Virginia, though, don't they? Maryland has two Revolutionary War figures.
Well, you can't change the perimeters on me.
D.C. has Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass. I think we need people that are inspirational, those who contributed to our progress, despite having to face such enormous obstacles to move our country forward. And these are pioneers. So if that is the criteria to your point, but you asked me who I'd like to see, and I'd like to see women represented in our state capitol.
You were reelected to represent District 51 in Prince William County this past November. We didn't have you on during your first term, so welcome now for your official Politics Hour debut.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself outside of your work in Richmond.
So I am a mother of two. Cybersecurity specialist for the Department of Homeland Security. Did that for 20 plus years and currently still employed.
Did that in the Coast Guard first, didn't you?
I did. Coast Guard first. I was one of very few women who had a seat at the table right after 9/11 and worked on plenty of projects, standing up the most largest component of DHS.
Which part do you work for now?
I won't reveal the agency, but I'm still with DHS.
I thought it was TSA. Am I?
Yes, that's who I am with TSA.
Are you a contractor or are you an employee?
I am a contractor.
Okay.
The Hatch Act, as a Fed, when I decided to run for office, so I quit. And 2 days later, I filed. And the rest is history, so they say.
So, well, since you're a cybersecurity expert, we got to ask you this because this is at the top of the news cycle today. I need to ask you about the escalation of tensions between the United States and Iran. Early Friday, Baghdad time, the United States targeted and killed Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, in a drone attack at the Baghdad airport. Iranian leaders said today that this is an unequivocal act of war and that they're going to retaliate. And the speculation is that that may mean retaliation through cyber attacks. What would can that kind of attack look like, and what would it mean for the average American?
So let me speak at it to this in the context of my experience after 9/11. Not to saying that the retaliation will look like that, so I want to make that clear.
Sure.
But just to tell you how our world changed once we knew we were already doing information security across DOD and in some non-DOD entities were assisting in those efforts. But after 9/11, our world looked a lot differently on the cyber front, right? We had information warfare, things that we could not disclose publicly, you know, about what that looked like. And we ramped up our efforts. Some agencies who were never a part of DHS or was not, you know.
Well, more than the history, do you think this country is prepared for whatever may come next?
Well, we have wonderful expertise and talents across, our nation in this area of cybersecurity. We constantly work at securing our infrastructure, constantly protecting our data that assists in some of our military efforts and non-military efforts. But I will say this. You can't really speculate what this is going to look like because we see what's happening already. We saw what happened in our elections. That's what a cyber attack would look like. We see how information can be easily transmitted. We've seen that play out throughout the media. And I would say this, it's dangerous to speculate what our cybersecurity world will look like after this attack.
Do you think Virginia government is ready?
Well,
could do more?
Again, I think it's something that we will have to take a deeper dive. You know, this has just happened. This incident has just occurred. And I think we need to leave it to not only specialists who are dealing with national security issues and cyber issues and things to really figure out what that's going to look
like. Last year, you sponsored a bill that would increase cybersecurity training for state employees in Virginia. What bills relating to cybersecurity are you hoping to introduce and pass this session?
Well, you'll see a lot of those come through. Let me reframe that. You'll see bills that are pertaining to cybersecurity that are released. So privacy is a big issue. That's not just about what everyday Virginians are concerned about, but that's one of the issues that were amplified during the campaign trail. You know, as we become increasingly educated and aware of what cybersecurity attacks look like, to your earlier point, we have to do things to protect our critical infrastructure. This could mean, you know, making sure operations for police and EMT are encrypted when they're using their, what do you call that device? Their CBs and things like that when they're transmitting tactical information. So we want to make sure that we are prepared and that we move Virginia to forward in preparation for any type of cyber emergency that.
Well, let me ask you about a state issue, redistricting.
I was about to go there.
from cyber to redistricting.
There's concern the Democrats, now that you're in the majority, will not go forward with an independent citizens commission to redraw the lines. Mm-hmm. Where are you on that issue?
So we did pass redistricting reform. It was one of the most.
You have to pass it again, and then the voters pass
it again.
Are you for it?
So we fought very hard for independent redistricting. We've been constantly blocked on some of these particular,
Yeah, but it comes up for a vote again.
Reforms that we've wanted to see. It does come up for a vote again. But we have introduced redistricting reforms in years past, right? And so we've been constantly blocked from passing these types of reforms.
Yes, but coming up, the legislature passed it overwhelmingly last year. You now have to pass it again in the same substantive form, and then it goes to the voters. Some Democrats are saying, hey, why don't we just do it ourselves? We're in control. Do you want the commission or not?
So I would say this. There are legitimate concerns about some of the issues about the current piece of legislation regarding redistricting reform. We have to move forward in making sure that we have fair maps across the Commonwealth, right? We've seen what unfair maps has done. It's kept Democrats out of office and people of color out of office for over 20-plus years here in the Commonwealth. And the system, we have in 2017, we have overcome a lot of our gerrymandering issues just by the state of the presidential
election. So you're election. Open.
But
you're,
wait a minute.
So you're open to change or
well,
not change.
Most members of the Legislative Black Caucus, of which you are a member, opposed the legislation the first time around. And I'm suspecting they will oppose it this time around. But you voted for it the first time around. So are you saying that you are still in favor of an independent redistricting commission?
I would say that you may hear conversations about how we're going to address those concerns in the upcoming legislative session. We do need to move Virginia forward. If you, the way we passed, you know, amendments or our constitutional amendments, we have time now to look at this piece of legislation and really have a thorough dialogue.
Okay, so you're not going to make a position. Let's do something that's more to the heart of what people do. The governor has proposed raising the gas tax. I believe in your interesting background, you worked for a gas station.
I did.
You see how people come in and buy $1.25 worth of gas to get them to the next place. What do you think about raising the gas tax? I think it's 12 cents. I can't remember all the reasons why he wants to do it. But also there's a group that wants to raise it another 17 cents for carbon emissions issues. That would be almost 30 cents. A gallon for gas. Virginia has one of the lowest gas taxes in the country.
Yes, we do.
Are you prepared to raise the gas tax?
I would say the premise of your question would assume that it would possibly be a bad thing for us to do that. But we need to look at funding and how we're going to fund projects like transportation, education, and things that we are needing to, again,
address. I think Virginia has one of the lowest in the country. So raising
we do.
I don't have a personal opinion, but you certainly have room to raise the gas tax.
We do have room, and I think that's a fair statement. We have room. We have to see what that proposal looks like before we can say, yes, I'll do this or no, I won't. But I think this is one of the ways we can raise revenue in order to fund those specialty projects.
Here is Chris in Falls Church, Virginia. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, and I wanted to say congratulations on your reelection.
Thank you.
I'm a volunteer activist for gun violence prevention, and I called to ask you to please vote yes on the 8 bills that will be presented to the legislature, particularly the universal background check bill and the localities bill, the bill that will allow each community to vote on whether they want their city hall, town hall, or county government center to be a gun-free zone. And that would allow each community, depending on what they want to do, and they get to make the decision. So please vote for that bill, too.
Your turn.
Okay, so I haven't reviewed the gun-free zone bill that you're talking about. I'm still reading through all the bills that are crossing our desk. But for me, there have been too many shootings over the past few years. I've lost my father to gun violence personally, so I know the impact of gun violence. And we recently saw the incident in Virginia Beach. We have to act. That's the bottom line. This is an opportunity to make so much meaningful change. And I think we're going to do that with the legislation that we have proposed this year to include, you know, I do support common sense gun legislation, such as universal background checks.
What about one gun a month, which used to be the law? And you may bring it back. It was under Governor Wilder. You could buy one handgun a month, but no more. Would you support that law?
So, again, I don't want to speculate on what that law would look like, but we need to look at policy. Politics have been in play here where we have seen some really very dangerous rhetoric and narratives around gun violence prevention legislation. My job is to review the policy because policies are people. And that will impact my community as well as communities across the Commonwealth.
Got to ask you about this. You're one of the co-patrons of the bill to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Mm-hmm. It seems like a done deal that the vote will pass. Are you sensing any hesitation, however, from General Assembly members?
No. It's time that we bring this law into effect, enshrining women into the U.S. Constitution. And it's something that I fought for nearly a decade prior to my election as a women's rights activist. It's very meaningful to now have representation in the Constitution and making sure that women are treated fairly in our courts when it comes to ensuring that we get, you know, equality, not equality, but just equal treatment and fair treatment in the courts when they're judging against or hearing cases on discrimination, sexual assault, when you're talking about making sure that we enshrine this to empower us for future particular policies like paid family medical leave, and also making sure that we get equal pay. This is what ratification.
What about campaign finance? Virginia has some of the most lax laws right now. Between now and the opening of the legislature, there's like 60 fundraising parties for various delegates and senators to collect money that they don't even have to report until July. And so they'll go through the legislative session having all this money from interest groups and individuals. Do you think there ought to be tighter laws on what monies can be raised, how it's reported, and when it can be reported?
But
as you saw, these elections this past year were obviously the most expensive elections. Some people have spent $1 million.
I don't think that they're, you know, let me segment this a little bit. There is an issue. Virginia is the wild, wild west, right, when it comes to campaign finance laws, right? That is a given. We have to raise money when it comes to running for office. That's a given, right? You have to raise money. So any law that we put forward, we have to be mindful that even women of color, who don't nearly raise the same amount of money as some of our counterparts do, we need to look at these laws in a full 360 spectrum.
How about more disclosure?
I'm fine with transparency, but I think we have to really be thoughtful about legislation. We need reform, obviously, but what that looks like needs to be discussed in very thoughtful and thorough context.
You got quite a bit of your money in your last campaign because you refused to take donations from Dominion Energy. How come? Why don't you accept contributions from Dominion Energy?
So this was a people-powered grassroots campaign, people that supported our movement. This wasn't I dislike Dominion type of pledge. I took that pledge in 2017 initially. We need, when we're talking about climate change, when we're talking about reform, these are things that traditionally until I got in to the General Assembly, that we've seen that Dominion has had particular policies that favored their growth and impact on our communities, and we needed reform. So with that in mind, I marched to my own beat of my own drum and said, look, we got to, you know, empower our campaigns by the people that support us to get into office.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have.
I've got many more questions.
Hala Ayala is a member
of
the Virginia House of Representatives representing District 51 in Prince William County. She is a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kojo. Thank you so much, Tommy.
Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Sidney Grannon. Coming up on Monday, what role did guns play in the murder rate that plagued D.C. in 2019, the highest in the past decade? And with the rise of anti-Semitism across the nation, how is the local Jewish community responding? That all starts at noon until Monday. That starts at noon on Monday. Until then, have a wonderful weekend. What are you doing this weekend, Sherwood?
Nothing.
Zip? Nothing?
Nothing is one of the best things you can do to refresh yourself.
Oh boy, here we go again. I'm Kojo Nambi.
The Kojo Nambi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sidney Grannon, Margaret Barthel, Lauren Marco, and Maura Curry. Our managing producer is Mona Cashvey. Our engineer is Ben Privet. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org. WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nambi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.